Good evening, visitors. Hey, you guys look pretty ragged. Can you pay? Up front?
Shirley sent us. Said our money'd be well used over here.
Is this real, son?
Far as I know.
Huh. Well, I'll be damned. It is real. The name's Malibur. Maury Malibur. Hospitality chief of the Three Little Bears. I got a nice double. Big bed, shower, and everything. And you probably know about our, parlor.
We got room for another over here.
We'll be happy to take your money.
Well, thanks, but we really have to clean up and get some shut-eye. Maybe later.
Well, sure. Any friend of Shirley's is a friend of mine. I'll ring for the bellboy.
Malibur put on a small red round hat.
If you'll follow me this way, sir. We've got whatever you need here at the Three Little Bears Motel. If you need anything, anything at all, call up the front desk, and the hospitality chief will come help you out right away. Ah, and here we are. Your room. And here you are. Big, comfortable. Please take note of the wood paneling and the paintings of seagulls. They're all Malibur originals, all for sale. Your television set is currently playing a Western, and you'll find your sheets and towels on the bed.
Wow, thanks. What? Oh. There you go. Oh, 5 rubles.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. Hope you have a pleasant night.
Well, here we are.
Shower!
Go right ahead, but save some for me. Pretty good. Did he say there was a Western on television? Couldn't be.
Reach for it, or Nura will blast you to the sky. Reach for it, or Nura will blast you to the sky.
Yeah, I should have known. That's better. Don't forget, Archer. Don't take too long.
Fire!
No, no, Archer. It was just the alarm. Get up. We've got a big day.
Room service.
Come in.
Ah, there you are, all awake. You'll notice I took the liberty of cleaning and pressing those clothes you had lying in a heap by the bed. You'll find them in the bathroom. Also, I've got your breakfast right here. Ah, there we are. Checkout's at 11, unless you want to pay another night.
I think I'm running a little low on rubles.
Well, if you think there's another motel around here, you'd be sorely mistaken. We're the only one north of the Mason-Dixon line. You're lucky as hell even to find us.
Well, in that case, maybe I can win some money back in the game room.
That's the spirit! You might! Then again...
Hey, come on, Archer. All that's not for you. Leave some for me. And then we'll win some of that money back.
Call?
I raise 5.
I'll see your 5 and raise you 10.
I'll match that.
I fold.
I win again!
Yeah.
We'll see how you do next round.
You boys got room for one more?
Malibur, you know we'll always let people give us their money.
Which seat should I take?
Take the one next to Bart the Bastard. He's the one with the pencil mustache and leather jacket.
Ah.
Name's Handsome Jack. Like I said, the gent next to you is Bart the Bastard.
Oi, nice to see a new face.
And the old geezer with the pink hair is One-Eyed Swamp Rat.
Hello there, stranger.
Hi, One-Eye. Why do they call you...
Because I got one eye, that's why.
Well, yeah, but...
And the beefy-looking lumberjack to your right, what's your name again?
The name's Shorefoot, stranger. Pleased to meet you.
Thanks.
Now that introducing's out of the way, let's start a new game. We're playing poker. 5-card draw. You know the game?
I've played a few hands.
Good. Whew. Rhubarb and tobacco. Want one?
Sure.
Here you go.
That's good.
Well, the secret's that I grew the tobacco myself on pig manure.
Great. That's really great.
With Rock's newfound psi ability, he could sense if the person who was raising had anything or was just bluffing. It paid off. A pile of gold pieces, watches, jewels, and rings filled his side of the table. Handsome Jack looked more and more disturbed, and at last took out a big silver-handled revolver.
To keep it honest.
Suits me. I never cheat.
Yeah, Handsome Jack, he's a mighty lucky fella. But I've been watching him. Him and his friend stand behind him. They're not signaling or nothing. He ain't cheating, Handsome. Relax.
Handsome Jack won a few rounds, but Roxon thought he saw something flick down his sleeve several times. He took out his long-bladed Krieger knife.
To keep it honest.
Sure, sure.
There were no more movements down the sleeve. Soon the crew, except for Rock and Handsome, were out of cash and madly scribbling. Surefoot, the lumberjack, was down on his luck that day. He finally opened a greasy wallet from which he extracted a key.
Keys to my 83 Buick Roadmaster, specially equipped for long hauls in hostile territory. Guess that keeps me in the pot. Must be worth 1,000 rubles at least.
I'd like a look at it.
Sure. Just take a look out the window there.
Which one is it?
It's the red one. No rust, thick treaded tires.
Does it go?
Does it go? Man, that thing will beat the hell out of anything on the goddamn roads. Runs on alcohol, got the engine in the back seat, and a 200-gallon storage tank.
What's with the chimney and the steel-plated ass?
That's for any problems on the road. The chimney's for the engine. There's also a 55 mounted in the front, and there's inch-thick steel sheet on the back. Fucking thing will stop a cannon. Also got an instant fuel dump, which shoots out all the alcohol in case of an accident or something. Also got...
Okay, I believe you. All right, I'll accept the car as equal to the stakes on the table.
Roxon watched both Handsome Jack and Surefoot. They made brief eye contact, and Roxon's ESP detected the briefest spark of satisfaction between the two of them. So they were working together.
Anybody else? Right. All right, boys. Show your cards.
Here you go. Full house. Kings on top. Read them and weep, stranger. Looks like all this gold is coming my way.
Royal straight.
Well, I'll be a shit-eating rattler. God damn it, Jack. You pretend to be my partner and you suck me into this. All this time, you've been working with this newcomer here, setting me up! Well, I'm gonna keep...
You don't kill. I'd listen to my friend if I were you. He can get pretty mean. Archer, let go of the man's hand. Now, Malibur, take what's owed to you out of the pot. Let's go check out that Buick, huh?
The two free fighters lugged their winnings, some skunkskin pelts, a bag of wrist and pocket watches, a half dozen leather-bound books, several bear traps, and two pistols, along with the loot, over to the car. Rock walked around the freshly painted red vehicle. It had a chrome grille through which the muzzle of the 55mm machine gun poked. He stuck his head in the driver's window and saw bucket seats made out of fiberglass and a surprisingly sophisticated dashboard with dials and computerized systems checks. A joystick at the other side of the seat apparently controlled the machine gun with a red button on top for firing. But there wasn't time for a complete investigation. He could feel the waves of anger towards them and knew Surefoot would try something, anything, before long. He and Archer climbed in as Malibur walked over to them, his hands at his sides to show he had no weapons.
Just want you to know that I think you want every bit of this here car, fair and square.
Well, thanks for the hospitality. I appreciate it. I'll tell all my friends to stop by here if they're ever up in this neck of the woods.
You do that now, and come back yourself. You gotta give us all a chance to win back some of this stuff.
Sure. So, how long do you think before Surefoot goes back to get his gun? Yeah, about that long.
They turned a bend in the road and were quickly lost behind trees. As soon as they were out of sight of the motel, Rock slowed down a little. It handled fine, but the going was bumpy. They headed down the dusty one-lane road that had once been Route 66, quickly hitting 80 miles an hour. Animals darted for cover as they heard the roar of the roadster approaching. Suddenly, Rock felt happy to be alive. With the sun beating down and the breeze on his face, his heart welled up with an inexplicable joy. It was a hell of a world in America 2090 AD, yet he wouldn't choose to have been born in any other time or place. Hands with fingers as thin as bone pressed against the dark blue glass of the 80th floor of the Monolith, the headquarters of the KGB in America, making damp impressions on the cool surface. Outside, the sun was just coming up over the mountains. Colonel Keeloff stared through the tinted picture window that surrounded his top floor suite of living quarters and private offices. Keeloff, the Skull, the Colonel, or just plain death to those who knew him or had the unfortunate fate of feeling his wrath. His official title was Colonel Keeloff, commander of all USSR KGB forces. Every black shirt in America was under his iron-fisted rule. Keeloff's thin lips were squeezed tight as the greedy mouth of a small woodland rodent. His drug-crazed eyes burned like incandescent blue bulbs. He reached for another Olivelle and a capsule of Transcendol. His drug use had reached insane proportions. Even he knew that. His doctors, those who dared speak up, told him he only had a few years to live if he didn't change his habits. He barely slept anymore. His life was more of a walking dream, a nightmare in which death slept under every door, crawled beneath every log, glistened in every eye. His body had shrunk to hanging leather flaps of skin that sagged down from his arms and legs. His face was concave, the cheeks sunken as if shovels had dug out whole chunks of flesh. A protruding red scar ran along his cheek from just below the eye to his jawline. A present from Ted Roczen. Roczen, who was always somehow just out of reach.
Where are you, Ted Roczen? Somewhere out there, in those mountains, your precious Century City. I would give half my wealth, half my kingdom to get at you. You and that white streak in your hair and those mismatched eyes. How dare you stare at me without fear! I will make you feel fear. Someday, Roczen, you will be before me, begging, bloody, and screaming for your life. And now? Vasily wants you dead too. I have received reports on his movements. He has apparently enlisted the help of our German friends to take revenge against the humiliation you gave him in Moscow. I have heard reports that he had actually signed a peace treaty with you, and that you spat in his face, turned the day of the games into a farce, and destroyed the main ICBM control center to boot. I admit, I am impressed. Your courage is only surpassed by your stupidity and luck. Your days are truly numbered, American. Vasily's armies will lay waste to your venerable land. But what if the armies are directed against me? Certainly the Premier had at one point considered me the foremost threat to the Empire. I have to be cleverer than them. I have to prepare myself. If this is a strike against Roczen, then so be it. But if their forces veer north towards me and the monolith, I will have to be ready. Yes.
Yes?
Wake up, fool. This is Colonel Kilov. Eighth Wing Commander Petronin, I want the entire squadron on 24-hour alert. You understand, idiot? This is a mode blue status.
Yes, sir. Immediately, sir.
Call me to confirm within 15 minutes. Yes? Come in! Come in!
I have your vegetable juice, Colonel Kilov. Your doctors told you.
Yes, yes. Bring over the sludge. Oh, I despise this slew the doctors give me.
Here you are.
Disgusting. Be gone with you!
At once, sir!
Kilov sat alone, staring straight ahead. He could see his reflection in the glass window about 8 feet away.
Oh, God. I look mad. But madness is a kind of genius. A genius of death, terror, and betrayal. Enough. I must review our reports. Somehow, there could be a hole. They could have a trick up their sleeve. I will need my neutron bombs ready. 5 of them, and my entire system of anti-missiles. And ground-to-air defenses. Yes, I will be impregnable.
10 stories below the musings and rantings of the KGB commander, a black-cloaked figure moved steadily up the smooth, glass-sided outer surface of the monolith. On each of his hands and knees were attached large rubber suckers that stuck firmly to the wall when he planted them there. The assassin stopped and looked down for a moment. He was already 70 stories up. The grounds, the gates far below that surrounded the immense circular building, the guards making their regular rounds, all looked as small as bugs, mere insects incapable of even seeing him up here in the darkness. He loved it like this. The harsh ninja training had all been worth it. Russian camps in the southern tip of the Sakhalin Oblast had captured ninjas in the northern tip of Japan. Once taken prisoner, they were forced to divulge all the tricks of their trade. Thus had Ilyich Derzhevsky been transformed from a regular army commando into the hard-faced one, as he had come to be known. For he had chosen as his attack suit a many-pocketed, multi-weaponed black nylon ninja suit and cape, and the black opaque face mask shaped like a kabuki demon through which only his bottomless brown eyes showed. He had been one of the best and had killed many men already. But now President Zhabnov himself had commanded him to destroy the skull. He was one of a group of 5 assassins sent out on the mission. 2 had failed already, but the hard-faced one would not. He edged up the side of the building, seeing the roof just above. He was at the 80th floor. Careful, Kilov was almost certainly in there. He would be alone. Any sound would jar him in his drugged-out, nervous paranoia. He must be fast and instantaneous in his attack. Kilov was far tougher than he appeared. The hard-faced one's masked eyes rose slowly up to window level and peeked in. There, he could see the KGB commander sitting at his table just a few yards away, checking papers. The ninja edged along sideways, keeping the colonel's back just in eye range. He moved a good 50 feet along the side of the building until he was past a wall and facing another section of the top floor suite. The clouds rolled by just over his head, a few hundred feet up. The sun's morning rays were just creeping down the building. There wasn't much time left. The hard-faced one reached up with his hands, and a diamond-edged blade snapped out into his right hand from a wrist spring beneath his wide-sleeved silk jacket. He began cutting a circle in the glass. Moving slowly, the cutter was powered by supersonic waves along the blade edge, enabling the diamond teeth to cut quickly and deeply into even inch-thick glass with hardly a whisper. Within minutes, the ninja removed the oval piece of cut glass with a sucker and rested it against the 6-inch-deep metal ledge that ringed the building. He hoisted himself up and through the hole, moving one joint at a time, making no sound. He had trained in all the martial arts, in yogas, in meditations so esoteric that no normal man could even comprehend them. And now he was able to move like a gymnast, a spider, a warrior, all in one black garbed body. He stepped down on the floor of the room. Kilov was within reach, just on the other side of the wall. From underneath his robe, the ninja pulled it out, the weapon with which he would destroy the skull. It was a simple device, a piece of wire with a 2-inch blade at the end, attached to a motorized metal handle. The ninja grinned beneath his black demonic mask and pressed a button on the side of the handle. The steel blade began spinning at the end of the steel whip, which shot around in a circle in front of the ninja's chest. He pressed another button and the wire fed out another 2 feet, a whip of blood and death. The hard-faced one walked through the door and toward the colonel, stepping light as an ant, moving as he had been trained to walk across rice paper without tearing it. The cutting wire swung around and around, reaching toward the colonel's neck, reaching to slice through bone and sinew like blades of grass. One more second, and Kilov felt a tingle run up his curved spine. He didn't move a muscle. Something. A breeze.
Very good, Colonel. They said you were fast, but not fast enough.
Kilov slammed his hand over the wound on his upper arm and looked at it for the barest second. He could see the flesh opened up in a bloody V and into the wet, white bone below.
Colonel, don't you want to die? Come now. You are the master of death, aren't you?
Whoever you are, I don't care. Let me live. I'll pay you 10 times whatever they're giving you.
Colonel, I have enough money, women, food to last me 10 lifetimes. You see, I've trained my entire life to kill you. This is my fate. Once your death is mine, I will not even care whether I live or die.
Kilov slowly walked to the front of his desk. If he could just lure the killer onto the section of carpet in front of the center of the desk.
And now, Colonel, that you have felt the sharp tongue of my spinning friend here, perhaps a few more cuts, and then your head.
The skin on Kilov's leg flapped down, hanging only by bloody veins as red gushed down the trembling leg.
Oh, look at you crawling away like a dog. No more fighting you, eh? It is such a shame that none of the stories were true. You're just a decrepit old coward, trying to hide behind your desk.
I never hide from my enemies.
A concealed metal plate underneath the assassin whirled to life. The bolts ripped through his feet and legs, through his groin and his skull. His body began smoking, his eyes and brain bubbling in a streaming pink porridge out of sockets and ear holes. Kilov, his hand wrapped over his leg wound, slithered back behind his desk, sat in his chair watching the burning, spasming creature before him. It was already dead, the colonel was sure of that. Its outer skin was already turning black and charring as the head burst into flames from the inside. Tongues of fire shot from the dead thing's mouth, licking out nearly a foot. Still, it jerked back and forth, caught between the electric fires. Amazing, the colonel thought as the corpse smoked, how much flesh and parts there are in a human body to make fuel. Perhaps someday. He watched until the ninja was just smoldering bones and lumps of fused charcoal on the singed rug.
I think that's good enough.
Kilov! Oh, my Kropkin! I had no
idea! I don't want to hear your silly excuses, Sergo. Call my doctors. Tell them to meet me in operating room 3. And when that is done, sweep up the ashes.
The two free fighters made good time in the Roadmaster they had won in the poker game. Once Rock got the hang of it, He was steering down the plains and hills of Iowa like he was going through an obstacle course. The small tin chimney poked through the roof and spat out a constant stream of thin gray smoke. The weather remained fairly cloudy, which was just as well as far as Roxanne was concerned. There would be red spy drones in this part of the country, and he didn't feel like walking anymore. If a drone dropped down close enough, it would pick up the engine and metal parts of their vehicle and close in for a closer examination. And then... but they'd just have to chance it. Over the next 3 days, they covered a good 600 miles along the fairly flat salt seas and pebble-strewn dead lands that stood between them and Century City. On the third afternoon, they came upon a herd of black-furred buffalo, immense and mangy, chewing the thin cover of grass and staring lazily at the approaching car.
Archer, you hungry?
Yeah.
Why don't we test out this gun, then? Try pushing the button in front of you, Archer. You made the kill shot. The buffalo's all yours.
Archer jumped out, and with the deft expertise of a tried and true mountain man, skinned off some of the best and most tender meat from the shoulders and upper thighs. He cut the meat into 20-inch thick steaks and headed back to the car, which was puffing out a funnel of smoke.
Hey, maybe the top of that alcohol engine back there is hot enough to fry up some of the steak. Sounds good.
After they ate, Roxon kept on a dead-ahead course, keeping the sun in view as he tracked it across the hazy sky, a dim beacon behind the curtains of writhing clouds. The terrain became bumpier, and the Doomsday Warrior glanced out the side window. They were low enough in the bucket seats that it was like riding just inches above the earth. He could see little bumps everywhere on the ground, as if the soil had erupted with sores, pimples of radioactive disease. Far off to the right and left of the speeding car stood two immense A-bomb craters, like dead volcanoes. Suddenly, he saw a blurry shape off to the right, coming in fast. It looked bizarre, some sort of truck-like top built on a small-framed car body. The high truck looked absurd, bouncing from side to side as if it were about to fall over, obviously too big for the frame that supported it. Three men stood on top of the truck. They all looked barbaric, with scars covering their faces and brightly colored Mohawk haircuts. Dangling from the side of the lumbering vehicle was, what looked to Rock, human skulls.
Shit! Archer, hold tight! I think some bandits have found us, Archer. Keep a close eye for any others. That one was probably a scout.
Archer, I hate bandits.
I know you do, buddy. Shit! There's a vehicle straight ahead. Archer, man the guns!
Archer sat bolt upright in the bucket seat as he saw the Volkswagen minibus ahead, armed with a giant ramming spear on the front.
The gunman! Just aim it forward and fire!
Archer took hold of the joystick controls of the 55mm poking through the grill of the Roadmaster and pushed the fire button on top.
Good one. One down.
But the truck was still after them, and Roxon had a growing feeling that there was more to come. Then he saw them, a line of four advancing cars, each over a century old, their very bodies cracking apart, their windshields held in place by ropes, their wheels ground down so that there was just inches of rubber between the ground and the spinning steel axles. Yet they moved. Lurching and weaving, they came forward.
Archer, fire!
The bullets sliced across grills, doors, and tires, slamming into metal and twisting it apart. Two of the cars caught fire, their fuel lines severed. Rock aimed straight between the blazing vehicles.
Well, shit.
There, ahead of them, were over half a dozen archaic vehicles. All of the half-rusted cars and trucks from pre-war America were filled to the brim with barbarians. Four of the trucks had wooden platforms built on their backs, rickety structures that rose a good 15 feet into the air, atop which a small cannon had been erected. The fleet advanced toward Rock, their wooden platforms shaking and leaning back and forth as if they would fall over. Rock could see the men behind the metal cannons loading them by hand with fist-sized shells.
There's no way in hell we're gonna get through that bunch. I'm gonna tear Ash to the right. The second you feel the car move, fire. And keep firing with that 55, you got me?
Yeah!
A name for those tower things. The cannon, you see him?
Archer, kill cannon!
Okay, hang on to your balls. Fire! It is. They're firing goddamn tank shells. Archer, I'm gonna swerve. Just lay down covering fire.
The fleet was hemming them in, but they couldn't keep up with the souped-up Buick. Surefoot had obviously poured his heart into the vehicle. He made it past the truck at the very edge of the fleet and headed out toward the miles of flatland ahead. But the bandits turned and took up the pursuit.
Man the back gun!
Back gun?
That lever switches from forward to rear machine gun.
Unable to see through the steel plate that covered the back window, Archer, keeping one hand on the firing button, leaned out the window to get a better view. The pursuers were right behind them, neither catching up nor falling behind. They had broken their straight-line formation and were moving in packs of three or four vehicles. The trucks with the tower cannons were in the second pack and were just getting a fix on their would-be victims.
Cannon!
Good job. Another two cars down.
Archer swiveled the machine gun slightly to the side, aiming for a truck with the cannon. He tracked his shots, aiming for the cannon's platform. The cannon flipped down towards the truck's hood the instant it fired. Some of the other cars were starting to fall back, unable to keep up the pace. They weren't used to having to pursue their victims more than a few hundred yards before a bloody capture was made.
Three left. Just keep firing. Shit! Hold on!
Oh, fuck! What?
Dirt in my eyes! Give me the water!
Be slowing, Rob!
I know! Give me the water! Thanks. Much better. I can see again. Shit! They're right behind us now! Damn it! They took out a tire! We're veering right now! There's no way we can outrun them! Wait! What was it Surefoot said?
Also got an instant fuel dump, which shoots out all the alcohol in case of an accident or something.
It could work. Close the windows.
Okay.
Roxon let the approaching attack cars pull even closer, his hand hovering on the evacuate lever to the right of the steering wheel.
Now!
The alcohol shot out 30 feet in all directions. Rock's car was already shooting off with its emergency reserve when the tank shell came down. The flames shot up nearly 10 feet, the alcohol burning with a quick but violent fury, and caught two of the attack vehicles directly underneath. There was but one truck left, and it continued the charge forward, the tower gunner feeding another apple-sized shell into his makeshift mortar. Rock spun the wheel as far as it could go, and the car made a full 180-degree skid. The two vehicles came toward each other. 100 yards, 75 yards.
Shoot, men, shoot!
The lever!
You're shooting from the back!
Oh!
Yeah, that's it! Aim a little higher! What's wrong?
No ammo!
Shit!
Knee clear shot!
What?
Roxon glanced right. Archer had pulled out his crossbow and was loading his last bolt.
All right. I'm gonna swerve to the left. Try to hit a shell if you can. If not,
Archer King.
Okay, now!
Roxon turned the wheel so hard that their truck turned on its side. Archer stood up through the window, crossbow in hand. He could see the gunman's face, scarred and pitted, with eyes blazing like the fires of hell itself. The two vehicles were now just 30 yards apart, and Archer could see the mortar trigger pull back. He aimed for the shells beside them. The two free fighters crawled out from the ruined Buick. Rock pulled out his Krieger hunting knife, and Archer swung his crossbow around to use as a club. But there was no one left to fight. They were all dead. A pile of burning cars and trucks extended back toward the horizon, each sending up its own swirling funnel of thick, oily smoke. The men inside the last truck that had come bearing down on them were all dead, hanging over their seats, their bodies ripped and twisted apart, sliced like badly butchered meat. The free fighters walked back to their roadmaster and examined it. It had served them well, but now after more than 100 years of service, it had met its maker. The front tire had been completely ripped from its axle by the force of the explosion. The engine seemed to have numerous holes in it. It leaked oil like dark blood onto the yellow ground.
Let's get our stuff and find a new ride.
They took their supplies and the winnings from the poker game and carried the load over to a nearby truck.
We're taking this one. Come on, help me get rid of the bodies.
Hundreds of planes filled the skies. Huge K-121 airlifter four-engine jet troop carriers that had set out 8 hours earlier from Munich, Berlin, and Stuttgart. They soared down from out of the clouds over the Red Fortress city of Zurich in southern Colorado, setting down one by one. Hundreds of thousands of Nazi troops, tanks, armored vehicles, and heavy artillery were ensconced in their steel bodies. The German invasion force was arriving in America. One landed every minute on the 2-mile-long desert runway, unpaved, hand-pounded dirt at the outskirts of the newly built invasion camp. Exhausted American slave workers looked up with fear in their narrow eyes as the giant transports dropped from the brown skies. The ragged, beaten, and sullen men, there were no women, they had been sent to breeding farms in Russia, had been up for days and nights, smoothing down the hard-packed runway with shovels and hand-pulled rollers. The wretched slaves had never seen such a concentration of power. Officers and troops were stowing their gear in hastily assembled barracks. Trucks and armored vehicles roared by everywhere. Red Army flags on fenders and swastikas on their doors. In the center of the camp stood the 5-story Soviet Army Command Center. At the side of the ominous windowless building stood a wooden platform, still splattered with blood from the night before. The scaffold of death for recalcitrant American workers who were brought there and slowly, over hours, strangled and tortured to death while their screams rang through the hovels. Ralph 66 was one of the unfortunate American no-men who had been shipped here months ago, along with nearly 20,000 other slave laborers from Red Fortress cities around the country. He had been up for 80 hours without sleep, but those who fell did not rise again without being pierced by a Red soldier's bayonet. So the bearded, pale worker staggered along for yet another day of back-breaking toil.
Oh, many jets.
What have we here?
What? Me?
Yeah, you. Do you see something interesting in the sky?
Oh. Nothing. I'm sorry.
Oh. Do not lie to me! You like troop planes, do you?
No. No, I only want to work. Only work.
Ah, that is good. Let me see your profile. Yeah, I see upon looking at your upraised face that you are of partly Aryan stock. I have a different chore for you, mongrel. Come with me.
Please, I only want...
Shut up! You don't realize how lucky you are today. You will serve to replace a dead bootblacky in my commandant's quarters. You will be fed, shaved, bathed, and clothed. Now, do you wish to go to work?
Thank you, sir.
He was taken to the servants' quarters in tents behind the general's building. He was cleaned, scrubbed, examined, and clothed in a magnificent dark green Nazi servant's tunic. He felt like a new man. He was now a boot servant, a high post indeed for a no-man. In just a few hours, he had to learn how to approach the general and help him on and off with his boots. He practiced on the other servant's feet until he was sore. His muscular, though wasted arms gave him the strength to put on the boots, with pressure, all the time lining it up and pushing or pulling. No twisting, for the general had a sore leg. The last bootblacky had been executed for twisting the general's ankle. He was taught well and felt fully competent by the time the evening boot removal was to take place. Still, it was with some trepidation that he approached such a powerful German. The command barracks were a giant, heated affair, 3 stories high, with immense double swastikas on the outer walls, sitting on the southern edge of the vast encampment. In the main first floor room, the commander of the American Theater of Operation sat on thick furs, drinking hot tea from a steaming samovar. Herr Ubenfuhrer Marshal von Reisling was a tall, squarish man with a patch over his left eye. He was impeccably dressed in his purple resplendent uniform and gold swastikas on each lapel. The general was preparing to meet with Günter Klaus and Helmut Heinz, the commanders of the 201st Wolfpack, the winner of the German All-Army Games the year before.
Yeah?
My general? I have come to put on your boots.
Very well, come in. Yes, yes, you are nervous. Put them on.
Ralph 66, sweating from every pore of his terrified body, carefully slid them up the wide calves an inch at a time. Outside the commander's barracks, Günther and Helmut stood at rigid attention, waiting at the honor guard's command to enter the forbidding quarters. Günther was the regimental leader of the 201st, a tall, angular-faced man with perfect Aryan features. His icy blue eyes seemed to ooze death. Beside him stood Helmut, shorter, plumper, but just as tough. He had worked his way up in the Nazi ranks and had fought his way at every inch. Brown-eyed, his features were much coarser, almost swarthy. It had been rumored by several under his command that his hooked nose betrayed Jewish blood in his heritage, but none dared breathe a word of such thoughts, for it would be their last. The two men stood like frozen statues, just feet outside the general's quarters. Only their slightly breathing chests betrayed the fact that they were alive. They visualized the beaming yet stern face of von Reisling as he would present the glorious flag to them. They did not shiver in their thin parade uniforms, though the midnight temperature hovered at 5 degrees. At last, they were escorted in by the goose-stepping honor guards and proceeded down the red carpet in the front hall to the general, who sat on a green silk chair, mounted atop a marble platform with foot-high gold swastikas surrounding it. The general rose, and as the two men stood at rigid attention, he walked around them.
So, you are Günther.
Jawohl, my general.
Your 201st Wolfpack will be the spearhead of the operation. Congratulations. You are no longer lieutenant, but a major.
Thank you, my Oberführer.
And you, Helmut, you will be promoted to major as well, effective immediately. You will be second in command of the Wolfpack. Sieg Heil!
Sieg Heil!
You are dismissed. And may the brave blood of the undefeatable German soldier flow through your veins. A long day. Bootblacky!
Yes?
Take off my boots. They pain me.
Of course, sir.
Not many people get to work under people that regularly speak to the Premier himself. In fact, I am expecting a call very, very...
Ow! Von Reisling, I'm so sorry.
Oh! Get out!
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir. My apologies.
Idiot.
Yeah?
Stein, this is Reisling. The new servant you sent me today, he's inadequate. Please, get me a new one, and one with the intelligence to put on a pair of boots.
Should I have him killed?
No, don't execute him. We've lost too many workers lately. Put him back on the airport detail.
Yeah, mein General.
Standing just on the other side of the doorway, Ralph 66 heard the conversation with tears in his eyes.
And I've just been fed, bathed, and clothed, and now I'm to be replaced? No. No, no. I would rather die than be returned to that hellhole outside. And I will take von Reisling with me.
Hello, Grandfather.
Good. You are there, Reisling.
I'm checking to make sure that all necessary preparations are proceeding according to schedule. There can be no slip-ups.
German efficiency has put us ahead of schedule. The planes all landed with but a single malfunction. The men are in their barracks, armed and ready. I am meeting with my officers tonight to give them final instructions. Morale is high, sir, very high.
Excellent. You know what the capture or death of this Ted Roxon means to me. When you have successfully completed this mission, there will be a position of power waiting for you here in the Kremlin. You understand me?
Fully, sir. We will capture this Roxon. Of that you can rest assured. 250,000 German soldiers will make sure of that. There is no way that he will escape.
From the servants' area, a door was being slowly opened. Ralph 66 stepped through, a shard of glass in his hand. He moved just an inch at a time so as not to alert the general. Perhaps American slaves will, in the future, say his name with awe. Perhaps it will be banned from even being uttered, like Ted Rock.
What was that noise?
A difficult servant has been replaced, Grandfather.
Von Reisling smirked. His eye patch was, in fact, a sophisticated radar device with a 360-degree field of scan. Von Reisling had had too many enemies over the years, too many assassins trying to take his life to have not learned a few tricks. He had seen the man coming from the moment he had stepped through the door. Gunter's 201st Wolfpack Commando Detachment were the first to advance to the invasion site, some 30 miles from the comforts of the sprawling base. The 201st's orders were to scout the terrain and send back intelligence reports for the rest of the 250,000 man army of this unknown and treacherous land in the midst of the Rocky Mountains. And if the free fighters were waiting, they would be the first to engage in combat. Gunter was ready. Proud to hold the banner of the bravest, the best of the German army. The men lined up at the open door of their K-121 airlifter, their parakeets strapped to their bodies. Gunter, who always led his men into battle in the front ranks, rather than the rear as many officers preferred, was the first to hit the silk, leaping from the wide bay door. His parakeet snapped open, and he caught one of the high currents, heading into a slow, curving glide. But he didn't like what he saw below. Swirling clouds snapping around the atmosphere like serpent's teeth, ready to strike out with all of nature's omnipotent fury. Fierce winds whipped his parakeet, stretched out to its full 8-foot wingspan. The nylon folds catching the full force of the blasting wind, buffeting it back and forth like a leaf in a hurricane. It was hard to keep the damn thing homed in on the radar signal that had been dropped the day before by parachute, marking their drop site. The rest of the wolf pack were hanging onto their parakeets for dear life. They filled the skies around him, over 200 of Germany's toughest fighters, men he had known since they had marched together in the Hitler Youth. He skillfully steered his parakeet through the increasingly stronger blasts of hail and snow, until at last he saw the outlines of a 300-foot-wide outcropping on the mid-slope of a towering ice-capped mountain. That would be Pike's Peak, 14,100 feet above sea level. He had made it. Gunter quickly turned to see the rest of his wolf pack soaring this way and that, like a flock of birds gone mad. They were all having trouble in the stiff winds and the now blinding snow blowing horizontally. He saw a man high above smash into the edge of the mountain and fall from his parakeet. But the rest of the squad somehow made it, slamming into the plateau in crash dives, jumping from them, even landing upside down. Within 5 minutes, all but three of the pack were on the outcropping and gathering around their leader. They broke into their preordained groups and began heading up the mountain. Gunter took the lead, and Helmut brought up the rear. Heavy snowflakes blanketed them, cutting their visual range to less than 3 yards. It was the kind of storm that didn't even exist before the nuke war. The all-out atomic holocaust had set the Earth wobbling on its axis. The sun would rise from the southeast one season, the northeast the next. The magnetic poles were reversed, causing wild electrical storms and fluctuating climates. nearly 80% of the Earth's population was dead in 3 years. But slowly, ever so slowly, the forces of nature began to reassert themselves. But the planet would never again be how it was before the bombs fell. Now, it was a world where non-mutant men, except in the lowest elevations, were forced to don oxygen masks when walking or exerting the slightest effort. It was a world filled with a flashing, aurora-filled purple sky at night and green strontium clouds high in the daytime sky. And the megastorms, with their winds of hundreds of miles per hour, hurling rocks the size of baseballs through the air, twisters spawned by the hundreds, ripping up all that stood in their path, rains of putrescent skin-dissolving acids, and spiral-shaped black snowflakes of super-hard ice that could tear and rip an unprotected person to shreds. Or a storm like the one Gunter and his wolf pack were trying to fight their way through now, crawling along, bent over as if they were savage no-men instead of proud soldiers of the master race. The wolf pack were covered from head to toe in form-fitting plasticine suits, with an oxygen mask and radiation filtration system shaped somewhat like the astronaut helmets of old. He had just the slightest opening between his gloves and the snow-resistant suit when one of the black spiral snowflakes whipped into his wrist at 150 miles per hour. Blood poured out, soaking the bottom of the glove.
Everybody, double-check yourselves!
But men will be men, and laziness in America 2090 AD meant death. A sudden gust of 200 miles per hour tore off several helmets, exposing bare faces to the megastorm. Blood and flesh poured like mush and was caught by the screaming winds, sending out sprays of red that quickly dissipated in the blizzard. Gunter looked around him in horror. They hadn't even encountered the enemy, and already they were losing men every few yards, bodies falling to the black-covered ground, twitching as the ebbing heat of their dying bodies melted little ready-made graves for them. They were barely gaining ground now, the men clutching arms in long lines to avoid being blown away right off the plateau to the rocks below.
Look back, Tucker! We are being destroyed out here!
Clearing expected in 2 hours. Hold out.
Gunter stumbled on, trying to keep the lead, trying to make an example for his men. They must not stop. Not for a second, or they would be buried under a shroud of the Black Death. He placed one foot after another, moving by sheer willpower. The storm winds at last died down, gone as suddenly as they had come. The rad snows faltered and stopped. Gunter took stock of their losses. The fools who had allowed their face masks to come off were all dead, lying scattered around the slope. They were all fools. They deserved to be nothing more than food for the dark creatures that roamed these mountains. The glowers danced. They heard the music, the harmonies of the stars streaming down like the choruses of the gods. They danced to the music of the heavens, of the clouds, of the writhing molten lava and gravity waves deep within the earth. They moved in concentric circles, their blue bodies crackling and pulsating electricity. Without touching, they moved just inches apart, their outstretched violet fingers sending out flames of pure energy to the next of their kind in the spinning circle, cutting through the air like swords of lightning. They danced out the rhythm of existence, the movement of the energy spectrums, the meshing of rays and bands of energy beyond human comprehension, moving with the eternal ebb and flow of the universe. With their star blue eyes, they could see the waves of gravity of the Earth rising up to grab all things. The mega pulses of the quasars shot a billion light years through black space. Through their phantom flesh, they could feel the roaring, sucking, multidimensional forces of the black holes strewn throughout the galaxies, like endless black pits, from which nothing returned. They saw the stars, each distinct, different from the next. Blue, yellow, white, gold, brown, green, burning with the atomic fires that fueled existence. They touched the meteors with their minds flashing through the purple skies above, felt the comets soaring through the universe. Their bodies were impossible, grotesque. All of their internal organs were on the outside of their blue flesh, pulsing, heart beating like a glistening ultraviolet living creature. Internal organs writhed, sending out their currents and electric blood to one another. Their brains moved slowly like slugs, twisting this way and that within the transparent brain cavities, sending out and receiving the telepathic multi-spectrum messages of their fellow beings. The glowers, products of science after the bombs fell, paragons of genetic therapy. They had, through thousands of test tube generations, developed the ability to consciously resequence their own genome. They had consciously evolved so far beyond all other living things that they could no longer touch them. They could no longer eat, drink, or feel. So they developed other methods of gathering energy. They consumed light, radiation. And now, after years apart, they were all together. All 79 of their kind. Creatures linked mentally and emotionally in a single telepathic consciousness. They experienced each other as if they experienced themselves. And together they linked up with the superorganism of the planet and could speak to it as equals. At last they stopped and stood motionless. In the total stillness, their minds met, meshing firmly together like a vast mosaic that, when assembled, reveals a single but total picture.
The battle is here. The test of the Armageddon has arrived. The Roxxon has returned. He has survived his ordeal in Moscow, and now he is back. The warrior yet lives, but even his strength is not equal to the evil that is about to descend. He is but a man. We must act.
But we have never acted. We have always watched, observed. We have been part of the harmony. We have never entered or affected the world of the humans.
But now is a new time. Armies of darkness descend upon his home. If they are successful, there may be no more humans, no more glows, no more planet Earth. This cannot be. We must join the humans.
Yes, we've never destroyed before, except those who came to destroy us. But now, we must stop those who would send our planet into the black ether of frozen space. We must use our power, all of it, to turn the tide of history.
They pulsed together, brighter and brighter, until their bodies seemed to fuse, and there was but one blue ball of fire, spinning around them so that they appeared to be one solid entity of brilliant flame. Just as suddenly, the glow died out, and they bowed to one another. They headed out to their vehicles, sand ships with towering energy-collecting membranous sails. They headed toward the east, soaring just inches above the shifting Earth. They quickly reached their cruising speed of 50 miles an hour as they sped past immense black cactuses and wasteland animals that ran off at their approach. The glowers stood on the bows of their craft, staring straight ahead at the dark horizon. The sun began setting as they rushed forward, glowing like blue jewels in the night, to try to alter the destiny of mankind. Nearly 300 miles south and east of the glowers' advancing fleet of sand ships, a team of hybrid pack horses, their backs weighted down with heavy equipment, marched stubbornly across the rocky terrain. Small, bald men, thin as rails and hardly bigger than children, coaxed the breeds on.
Stubbornness equals willpower times the desire to avoid work.
Nearly 30 of the humanoid creatures, not one over 3 feet high, worked and yelled at the pack animals. These were the technicians, a race of super scientists. the descendants of the original missile crew that had manned the complex of silos in the Far West. There, the radiation had evolved their children into their present spindly form. The Doomsday Warrior had made contact with them many months before and had brought back a stash of their weapons. The Black Beam pistols possessed extraordinary power. They could destroy trucks, tanks, even planes from miles away with awesome results. A second team had been sent out from Century City to obtain more weapons and try to persuade some of the technicians to return with them. The hope was that Dr. Schechter, Century City's science chief, could learn how to produce the mysterious weapons himself. Erickson, the tall Swede, and Lang, a young star-pattern mutant like Roxxon himself, had been chosen to lead the second expeditionary force. After much hardship and struggle, they had reached the underground silo home of the scientifically ingenious Minimen, and the entire race had elected to return and help the American free fighters. Now, they moved slowly across the vast no-man's land on the way back to Century City. Erickson and Lang, tough as nails, with the same blue and violet eyes as the Doomsday Warrior, helped the techs move the hybrids along. 30 pack animals were piled high with black beam rifles and pistols, enough to arm nearly half the fighting force of Century City. At the rear of the force, pulled by two teams of 10 hybrids each, were two immense black beam cannons, almost 10 feet long, black and smooth as glass, mounted on crude wood-wheeled wagons. The weapons were capable of reaching to the moon. Thus far, the enemies of mankind had not managed to gain that as a military base. Lang rushed forward to Ullman.
How's it going?
It is progressively linear. According to calculations, we should reach your habitation within 5 or 6 time intervals.
You mean days, right?
Time periods of 24-hour gestation, affirmative. But these beasts of burden need more liquid sustenance, as do all the beings.
Yeah, they're looking a little pooped.
Water necessity equals weight of being times metabolism times the square root of temperature times 0.1222981. My calculations lead to the conclusion that cessation of physicality will occur within 3.2 days, unless liquid sustenance is obtained.
We passed a waterhole, an underground spring on the way here.
This was the first time that the race of technicians had gone more than a few miles from their subterranean missile complex, with its machine shops and storehouses of particle beam weapons. They had believed, until Roxxon had shown up, that they were the last beings left alive on Earth, and that almost the entire planet was as black and charred as the terrain around their base, which had taken nearly a direct hit a century earlier. Everything had been killed for miles around them, and even after 100 years, not a blade of grass had shown its green face through the hardened lava-like surface. Now they were out in the wilds of America, excited, brave, and terrified.
Water supplies will reach zero equation in precisely 17.6 hours at present rate of consumption.
It's there, I promise you. I've got no interest in disrupting my physicality.
You're like the Roxxon. He taught us how to survive alone, as individuals. As surely as you have shown us the wonders and terrors of this new world, you are an equation of strength.
What?
Behind them, one of the black beam cannons, weighing nearly 3/4 of a ton, had begun sliding to the side of the crude wooden wagon. As it tilted to the side, the front left wheel of the wagon cracked in two, and the entire primitive vehicle began tipping over to the ground.
The cannon must not make ground impact! The impulse will make its molecular structure implode!
Lang saw that he would never reach it in time when he suddenly saw Erickson coming up from the back, running at full speed. The big Swede grunted and strained with every fiber of his being as his muscles bulged and veins stood out on his face and neck. From the other side of the wagon, two technicians threw thin nylon loops of rope around the front end of the cannon and tied them to the backs of several Brits, keeping the cannon from toppling over. Lang had almost reached Erickson when he saw the Swede crumble. Everything moved in slow motion. Erickson suddenly falling to the ground, his hands ripped and bleeding, unable to support the weight of wood and the black beam weapon. As he fell, the upper half of the broken wagon wheel followed him down. Erickson had no time to move as the full weight of the load came down on his chest. The jagged half wheel ripped right through his body, severing the chest and backbone in half like a guillotine. A group of technicians ran over and placed a wooden support rod beneath the wagon and slowly, using the brids with ropes attached to their backs, righted it. They brought in a new wheel from their supply wagon and carefully replaced the damaged one. Within minutes, the wagon had been repaired and the cannon was out of danger, tied down more securely to the back. Lang kneeled down and looked at Erickson. His life had vanished in a split second. The wheel sliced through all his inner organs, his lungs, and then the backbone itself, severing the entire nervous system in one swift chop. The Free Fighter's eyes were still open, staring up at the sky. Tears welled up in Lang's eyes. He wasn't used to such feelings. Death came too easily on the plains of America 2090 AD to feel for those who had died. But he and Erickson had grown close on the long trek out. And now, he was dead.
We are ready to continue.
Okay. Just give me a moment.
Lang placed Erickson's body by the side of the ancient buffalo migration route they were following, leaning his head against the bottom of a tall sequoia cactus, rising like a dark spear from out of the gray plains. Lang stood over him, his hat held loosely in his hands.
Take this man, God, into your heaven, whatever and wherever it may be. I know that this man, Erickson, was a good and brave American who gave everything that he had so that others might live. Amen.
Erickson's corpse looked strangely peaceful, as if it were just sleeping in the shade of the towering cactus. But as soon as the team of animals and humans was out of sight, the earth around the corpse began moving. Tiny holes opened up in the hard-packed dirt, and long, undulating shapes emerged. Nearly 5 feet long and a foot thick, they wriggled their blood-red bodies toward the dead human. Their small, curved, beak-like jaws snapped into the cooling flesh. Within minutes, the body would be covered with bloodworms. They would consume the dead Free Fighter until there was nothing left.